This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Imagine you're at a dinner party and the conversation turns to the latest news. Everyone has a different opinion. People begin raising their voices. And you notice the person beside you isn't talking. They're just watching. They turn to you and make a joke. And you immediately relax. You hadn't even realized how tense you were. Then they ask you about the last movie you saw, or maybe an album you bought. And eventually they ask you what you think about the news. And when you respond, they're attentive. When they look at you, you feel seen. They ask you another question and another, and before you know it, an hour has passed and the arguing has died down around you. Your dinner party partner is what journalist Charles Duhigg calls a super communicator. They're all around us, and there's a good chance you know exactly who's a super communicator in your life.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I'm calling about your request for stories about super communicators. My mom is someone who I've always thought of that way. She's able to talk to just about anyone about anything at all and put them at ease. It may be because she's worked most of her life in retail and customer service, but she's really fun to bring to a social event and to introduce to my friends because she's great at making people smile. She makes them feel very comfortable. So I think that's such a gift of hers. So yeah, I think she's a pretty great example of a great communicator.
Sarah, thanks for that message. In his new book, Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection, Charles explores what makes conversations work and how we can all be better at them. And he shares what the research tells us. Later, when a producer, Haley Blassingame, takes her turn in the host chair to ask me how I approach conversations. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Stay with us. We've got a lot to get into.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Get your quote at progressive.com and see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Joining us now from Austin, Texas, is journalist Charles Duhigg. His new book is Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Charles writes for The New Yorker. He's also author of the books The Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better. Charles, it's so great to have you.
Thank you for having me. This is such a treat.
So, Charles, let's just start with the basics. How do you define a super communicator?
Well, a super communicator is someone who knows how to ask the right questions and to draw us out and to prove that they're listening. And as you pointed out, sometimes the easiest way to figure out who a super communicator is to ask yourself, if you were having a really bad day, who would you call that you know would make you feel better? And for many people, someone pops immediately into their mind. And for them, that person is a super communicator, and they're probably a super communicator back. But there are some people who can do this consistently, some people who can connect with almost anyone. And it's usually because they've just learned a couple of skills, a couple of tools that we can use that help us want to connect with others and show that we want to connect with others.
Super communicators aren't necessarily the loudest person in the room or even the most personable. So what qualities set them apart from other people?
Well, it's interesting. You're exactly right. When I first started reporting this book, I figured that super communicators would be extroverts and incredibly charming. And what the research tells us is exactly the opposite, that super communicators essentially come from all walks of life. And some of them are introverts and some are extroverts and some are charming and some are kind of curmudgeonly. But what sets them apart is that they have this ability to, first of all, ask the right kinds of questions, what are known as deep questions, questions that make us feel like they're genuinely interested in us. And then they can prove to us that they're listening by not only repeating back what we've said or asking further questions, but also by sharing something from their own life, sharing something of themselves. And these and a handful of other skills, they usually combine to send this message to us that I want to connect with you. I'm really interested in you. What you're saying matters to me, and I'm not judging you. Rather, I want to participate with you. And it's oftentimes that showing that we want to connect that's the most important part of actually connecting with someone.
What's interesting about what you're describing is, I think when you hear that term super communicators, a lot of our minds would automatically go to, say, a very popular politician, someone who can galvanize a crowd and get people really excited and worked up. But what you're describing sounds like something happening on a smaller, much more intimate scale, but it's also, there's a reciprocal part of it. There's a flow of energy that's happening that isn't just in one direction.
That's exactly right. And in fact, I would say, you know, those politicians who get us all riled up, they're using many of the same tactics, but most of us talk to people one-on-one or in a small group. And what happens is exactly what you just said, that there's this reciprocal authenticity, reciprocal vulnerability, reciprocal emotionality. And what's amazing is how impactful it can be. There's one story that I love about what happened at the ATT Bell Labs. Back when Bell Labs was the place where so many creations came from, some researchers looked to try and figure out why were some scientists more productive than others? Who got the most patents? And they couldn't find anything that these scientists had in common, except that those who got the most patents, they all tended to eat lunch or breakfast disproportionately with one of their colleagues. And that colleague, he would draw them out. He would help them think about things in new ways. He would ask them questions and bring up ideas that they hadn't thought of before. Sometimes an act of genius is actually helping someone else see something. And that's what super communicators can do.
We got this message from a member of our text club. Whenever I'm in a conversation with people I don't know, I try to find out what they like or are interested in. Everyone finds it easy and fun to talk about those personal things. I learned it from my father. He talked easily to both kings and the washerwoman who cleaned the floor. He was loved or admired by all who met him, especially me. Well, Charles, most of us can probably think of a conversation where afterwards we felt energized. We came away and we're like, oh, that felt really good. What's happening in our brains and our bodies when a conversation is going well?
So it's really interesting. And in the last decade, we've learned a tremendous amount about communication because of advances in neural imaging and data collection. And for instance, in this conversation we're having, we're separated by thousands of miles. But if we could notice it, what we would notice is that our eyes are starting to dilate at similar rates. Our breath patterns are starting to match each other. And even more importantly, the neural activity inside our brain is becoming more and more similar. The more we talk, the more we connect with each other. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because if I describe to you an emotion or an idea, you actually kind of experience a little bit that same emotion or that same idea. This is what communication is, we've discovered. It's the ability to become what's known as neurally entrained, to have our thoughts begin to match up with each other. But what's important is, if that's going to happen, then we have to be using the same parts of our brains at the same moments, which is why it's so important to figure out what kind of conversation is happening and match each other, because that allows us, helps us become entrained.
I want to talk more about the types of conversations we can have in a moment, but what led you to this book? What inspired you to think about the conversations we're having with one another, or maybe the conversations you were having in your life?
Oh, it was entirely because of I was doing such a poor job in my own life. I was a reporter at the New York Times, and they made me an editor, a manager, and I thought I would be fantastic at it. And I was just terrible at the job. I was good at all the practical parts of it, but I had so much trouble hearing what my colleagues were really trying to tell me and asking them the right questions and showing them that I was listening. And then I got into this bad pattern where I'd come home from work after a long day and I'd complain about my day to my wife. And she very reasonably would suggest a good solution. Like, why don't you take your boss out to lunch and you can get to know each other better? And instead of being able to hear what she was telling me, I would get even more upset. I'd say, like, why aren't you supporting me? You're supposed to be outraged on my behalf. And then she would get upset because I was attacking her for giving me good advice. And I wanted to figure out what's going on. Like, why I, a professional communicator, why am I so bad at this sometimes?
Well, we're hearing from lots of you. Another member of the Text Club writes, I love conversations. I enjoy listening to perspectives that are different than my own, and I often find myself refining my position as a result. Always be the student. And another of you shares, it's important that each person feels heard. When I was a very young doctor, just leaving my patients I cared for in my residency, I asked my patients what they wanted in their next physician. Many were concerned about the gender of their new physician, but one elderly woman said that she wanted a doctor who would listen to her the way I did. I will always remember her and that conversation. Well, Charles, you interview a wide range of people in this book. There's the CIA agent who's trying to recruit spies abroad. There's the surgeon struggling to talk to his patients about prostate cancer treatment. What was the common thread running through these vastly different situations?
What's interesting is the common thread is that they were all people who were bad at communication at some point and decided that they needed to get better. And this is what we see among consistent super communicators, is that often if you ask them, you know, what's communication like for you in the past? They say things like, oh, I had real trouble making friends in high school. I had to study how kids talk to each other. Or my parents got divorced and I had to be the peacemaker between them. And what often happens is that communication is so natural, so easy. Our brains have evolved to communicate that we almost do it unthinkingly without paying attention to what's actually occurring until something goes wrong. And then we have this real opportunity to start figuring out what actually happens in a conversation. And the people who start paying a little bit more attention, they're the ones who become super communicators because they realize, oh, there's a lot of choices that I confronted in that conversation that I didn't even recognize. And if I had made slightly different choices, things would have gone better. And it's that recognition, that sort of practice of the right skills that really is impactful.
Before we head to a quick break, let's go to this message we got from Anne, who emails, with some people, even people I'm just meeting, we find topics we can talk about endlessly. With others, conversations seem over from the start. I think about why this is. I realize that with conversations that never go anywhere, those people don't listen well. Most of us like to talk more than listen. Maybe that's human. I can't claim to be a master communicator by any means, but sometimes I do it right. Now, coming up, I recently got from behind the host chair to be interviewed by 1A producer Haley Blassingame. She asked me how I think about conversation and connection in my work as a host and outside of it. Back with more in a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Integrative Therapeutics, with vitamins and supplements previously available only through practitioners, including Cortisol Manager. Unlock your best self with clinician-curated supplements from Integrative Therapeutics, now on Amazon. This message comes from Jackson. Seek clarity in retirement planning at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial, Inc., Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Lisa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
Let's get back to our conversation. Now, while getting ready for the show, one of our producers, Haley Blassingame, wanted to ask me how I think about the power of conversation in my work as a host and outside it. Here's Haley.
In my opinion, Jen, you're what Charles Duhigg calls a super communicator in his book. These are the people we turn to for advice or who just make us feel comfortable in conversation. But I'm curious to know how the label super communicator does or doesn't resonate with how you see yourself.
Oh, that's a good question. It feels like a lot of pressure.
Superwoman.
First of all, when I think about that term super communicator, it's not something I apply to myself. Mm-hmm. Because for me, communication is so much about how the other person is receiving what you say and do and how you're engaging with them. So it's not a label I would ever apply to myself, but it's interesting to hear that you perceive me in that way. And I'm going to try not to flip the conversation back over to you, but I'm curious why you would apply that label to me.
Oh, well, I mean, so like I said, Charles describes super communicators. They're not the loudest people. They're not the people with the biggest personalities. They're the people who are the best listeners, number one. But also, I think like what you said, it's about how they make you feel, the space they make for you in the conversation. So I guess it is hard to know that of yourself because you're not in conversation with yourself. And I think for me, you're someone I come to and feel like I can just word vomit. I can just, you know, it's not, you know, I'm never second guessing or anything like that. And obviously I watch you do this every day, talking to people. So that leads me, I guess, to my second question, which is, what are the qualities of a good conversation to you? What does a good conversation feel like?
There are different types of conversations for me. And what is consistent across those conversations is an exchange of energy, if not language. So there are times when one person in a conversation is talking more than the other. But in the course of it, there's still this feeling of connection and that we are in the same space together at the same time. I've had conversations where I felt very much like the person was talking at me and not to me. Mm. And that makes it very difficult for me as the person on the receiving end to really understand, okay, how do I interact with this, even as a listener? Because it doesn't feel like you really want me to listen so much as you just want a place to sort of put whatever you're feeling. And I enjoy listening to people, and I enjoy that exchange of energy that happens even when it's just about being in a place of being receptive and being supportive through being receptive. And so for me, that's probably the core element, is that it feels like there is some sort of exchange of energy, not necessarily an equal exchange of words.
As we said, and as our listeners will know, you have a lot of conversations, probably more than the average person. 4 days a week, for 2 hours each day, you're having conversations with a variety of different people on subjects that range from the decline of local journalism to the rise of jazz among Gen Z. How do you approach all the different conversations you might be having in a week?
So even outside of the show, I start from a place of curiosity and from the perspective that no matter how much I know or think I know about this thing, there are things I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that creates space for me to engage with the preparation for the conversation and the conversation itself from the perspective of our listeners, from our audience, and allows me to not be in this position of, well, let me show everybody how much I know about this, but to really act as an advocate for people who are listening and to not be afraid to ask a question that I may already know the answer to, but that someone who's listening might not or probably doesn't know the answer to. And it also helps me be more attuned, not just to the facts of the conversation, but what's like a level or two deeper. Mm-hmm. So not just the what, but the why. not just the why, but the how.
As the host of a national show, you're not just speaking to the guests. You're speaking to our audience. But you're also speaking, some people might not know this, you're speaking to the producer.
Mm-hmm.
You're speaking to the engineer in the background. Mm-hmm. This is while the conversation is happening, the live conversation. And you're speaking to the stakeholders that allow us to keep having a show. So you're having multiple conversations with multiple people.
At the same time.
Yes. So when a conversation is asking so much from you at once, how do you juggle all of it?
As you were talking, I said, I had an epiphany about where I think I developed that muscle, where I built that muscle. And it starts around our family dinner table because I'm one of seven kids and our parents. And there were often, because my dad was a minister, there were often other people at the table too, especially when we would have big meals. Oh, and when I tell you the volume around the table. But what would happen is that you were often tracking more than one conversation at a time that was happening. And as a kid, I can remember being able to listen to these multiple conversations and sort of connect dots. Mm. And pull threads and engage in it over here and then engage in this conversation over here and then say, oh, so-and-so said this and did it. And I think it started there.
Is there a conversation that you've had either on the program or in your personal life that really challenged you? Every day.
Just one? Just one? Oh, boy. So a few weeks ago, I had to make the decision to put our dog to sleep, Misha. And she was 14, but she was healthy, right? She didn't have any serious health problems, things you keep an eye on for a dog her age, but active and, you know, just an amazing dog. When I took her to the emergency vet, just because I noticed that she coughed in a way that didn't sound normal, in the time that it took them to take her back to the exam room, do an exam, she was going into heart failure, into congestive heart failure. Talking to the vet, who was lovely, did what vets often do, which is they give you all of the scenarios. And I kind of put my journalist hat on, and I'm trying to read what she's really saying. And I couldn't get it. And I was like, what is she really saying? Is she saying she's dying? Is she saying? And I was like, what is the question that I can ask her that will help me understand? Because I don't understand what you're saying. And I said, if this was your dog, what would you do? And she hesitated. And she said, I have a senior dog who has heart problems, and what I can tell you is that you're going to end up back in this place with her no matter what happens today. And so that conversation was one in which, you know, it was difficult because I'm trying to make a decision about something. And I didn't know what question would give me clarity, but I knew there was a question that would get me to a place of clarity, and that was the question. If this was your dog, what would you do?
Well, thank you for sharing that. I know that's difficult, and we love Misha.
We do.
And I think your willingness to be vulnerable is why our listeners trust us with their stories. And we don't shy away from difficult conversations on the program. We're often handling difficult subject matter. Sometimes that means talking to people who are directly affected by the news. Sometimes we're the ones directly affected. How do you prepare for these kinds of hard conversations?
For me, one of the most important tools is therapy, because there can be an emotional toll. There have been times when I've cried on air, and it's not because I want to at all. The way people share stories and the types of stories they trust us with. I don't ever want to lose my empathy, but it gets inside of you. Mm. It gets inside of you. And so the most important thing for me is having a place where I can process that and talk about it.
Not everyone is fated to be a brilliant and poised NPR host. But what can people listening to this conversation take away to become better communicators in their own lives?
Listen. Of course, a conversation typically, again, it is an exchange. But I think when we start with listening and we give ourselves permission not to have the answers, but simply to be curious. I forget where I read it. Something about always asking one more question than you think you have to ask. Not feeling like you have to have an answer frees you up to be present in a conversation in a different way. It allows you to just be there. If you're in a space with someone who also understands that the importance of listening, the importance of curiosity, the importance of empathy, my goodness, like what a marvelous space to be in with someone.
And with that, Jen White drops the mic.
That was my conversation with 1A producer Haley Blassingame. Charles, I'd love to hear your reaction to what you just heard.
I thought that was beautiful. I mean, the fact that you are able to be so vulnerable, but also to hear other people is really just incredibly touching. And what I loved about it was that the things that you mentioned, particularly at the end, about being curious, about listening, about empathy, those are the core of the skills that in the book and the research tells us are important to becoming a super communicator. And I know as a listener of the show, one of the things that you're so wonderful at is asking a certain kind of question, a question that's known as a deep question. And what's interesting about a deep question is that can sound kind of intimidating, like something an NPR host should do. But what it actually means is that we're asking someone about their values or their beliefs or their experiences, that we're inviting them, rather than talking about the facts of their life, to tell us how they feel about their life. And when we do that, when Haley, for instance, asked you about a tough conversation you've had to talk about that experience, the recipient of that question often feels like a freedom to say something real and meaningful and vulnerable. And when we reciprocate that, we feel connected. It's actually hardwired into our brains. And so I thought it was just really beautiful.
It's interesting because I think not every conversation, of course, takes the shape of this deep, maybe emotional sharing or vulnerability. And you argue that whenever we speak, we're actually engaging in one of three kinds of conversations. What are those?
Yeah. And this is what comes from the research, is that we find that we think of a discussion as being about one thing, but there's often multiple kinds of conversations in one discussion. And mostly they fall into one of three big buckets. There's these practical conversations where we're making plans or solving problems. So that's what happened when my wife told me, you know, why don't you take your boss out to lunch? And then there's emotional conversations where I tell you how I feel, and I actually don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. I want you to understand. I want you to hear me. And then finally, there's these social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other in society, the social identities that are important to us. And what researchers have discovered is if we're not having that same kind of basic conversation at the same moment, that's when miscommunication occurs. So when I came home and I was upset and I was having an emotional conversation, and my wife responded with a practical conversation, we actually couldn't hear each other. It was difficult for us to understand what the other person was saying. But once we become aligned, what within psychology is known as the matching principle, once we become aligned and have the same kind of conversation at the same moment, then in a discussion, we can move from emotional to practical to social and back to emotional, and we're moving together, and we feel like we're connected, and Most importantly, we're genuinely listening and hearing what the other person is saying.
We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment. Stay with us.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Let's get back to the discussion with this message we got from Ursula, who writes, "If I could go back, I'd talk to my now ex-husband about what I needed and how I felt. I'd ask him and keep asking what he felt even when he made fun of me. The loneliness I felt then inspired me to develop deep listening skills. With persistence, self-awareness, and time, I can now show up for others and myself." We also heard from Paul, who writes, "I try to first understand others and then try to be understood myself." And Lori writes, "Super communicator is a misnomer. Maybe super listener is a more accurate title for Charles's book. Listening leads to a connection to communicate further." Thanks for all those messages. Charles, you know, as we've talked about, listening is an essential part of a good conversation. But it doesn't stop there when it comes to super communicators. There's something that happens beyond that. What else is going on?
Well, oftentimes what super communicators do is they not only listen really well, they prove to the other person that they're listening. And this is really important, particularly in conversations where we disagree with each other, where there's some conflict, as one of the listeners mentioned, during a divorce. There's always a suspicion in the back of our brain in a conversation that's hard that the other person isn't actually listening to us. They're just pretending to while they're waiting their turn to speak. And so as the listener, sometimes it's not enough just to listen. Sometimes we have to prove that we're listening. And there's a technique for this that's actually taught at Stanford and Harvard and many universities. It's called looping for understanding. And it has three steps. The first step is you should ask a question, preferably a deep question. Let the person speak. And then step two, repeat back in your own words what you just heard them say. And then step three, and this is the one we usually forget, ask if you got it right. Now, what we know is from based on studies is that if you loop for understanding in a conversation, the conversation almost always improves, sometimes dramatically. Because when I prove to you that I'm listening, there's a social instinct to listen back. This reciprocity of listening is inherent in how our brains work. And so not just listening, but sometimes proving we're listening, showing through a follow-up question or by looping for understanding can really help the other person believe that you want to understand what they're saying.
Another part of super communication is the way we mirror the person we're in conversation with. And you found that people who simply mimicked people's gestures or emotions without a genuine desire to connect with them didn't have the same success as a true super communicator. Where is the line, though, between using some of these skills to connect versus using them to manipulate or control?
It's a great question. And as you mentioned, there's a story in the book about a CIA officer who, for his very first job, he's sent over to Europe to try and recruit spies. And he is terrible at it. Like, just miserably bad at trying to get people to be spies for him. And in part, it's because he's mimicking them. Because when they tell a sad story, he tells a sad story. When they seem to be joyful, he's joyful even if he's not feeling that. And it doesn't work. And he's about to get fired and sent home. And so he goes to dinner with this one woman he was trying to recruit, and he just gives up. He just says, "Look, I'm so sorry. Like, I understand what you're going through right now because I feel so disappointed in myself. I'm just bad at this job." And when he's authentic, when he says something real, she can hear him for the first time, and she agrees to work with him and becomes one of the best assets in the Middle East going forward. And I asked him, Jim Lawlers is the CIA officer's name, why that happened? What made the difference? And he said, well, he figured out that when you go in with your goal of trying to convince the other person of something rather than expressing authentically what you're thinking or feeling, they know it. They hear it. We've all been in that conversation where someone asks us a question about our vacation, and we know it's because they want to tell us where they went on vacation, right? And so oftentimes the way that we make real connections is to take a moment, take a beat, ask ourselves what we're genuinely feeling, what we're genuinely curious about, and proceed from there. So matching, mimicking is not in itself enough. We have to authentically bring who we are, and we have to be authentic about what's going on in our own hearts and minds.
We got this question from Christine, who asks, how do you balance asking deep questions without seeming nosy? When does a good conversation cross over into intrusive?
Oh, it's a great question. And in fact, one of the things that's wonderful about deep questions is they don't seem deep when you ask them. There's a researcher named Nicholas Epley at the University of Chicago who ever so often he'll get on a bus and he'll sit down next to a stranger, and his goal is to get to a deep question within three questions. And so he'll say something like, oh, what do you do for a living? And the person says, oh, I'm an accountant. And then he asks, oh, really? Did you always want to be an accountant? Like, is that what you dreamed about being as a kid? That's two questions in, and he's asking someone about their hopes and their dreams. And it doesn't seem overly intrusive. It doesn't seem nosy. What it seems like is someone who's curious about us. And we can do this in any situation. And instead of asking someone, you know, where did you go to high school? We can ask them, what did you like about high school? How was it for you? When we ask about how people feel about their life, instead of the facts of their life, we invite them to tell us more about themselves. And that invitation isn't a commandment. Everyone can always say, oh, you know, high school was okay. But the invitation never feels bad.
We also got this from Philip, who writes, I use communication skills for my job and pride myself on being able to listen. However, my husband is the person I struggle to communicate with the most. Why is that? I mean, Charles, why is it easier to have this sort of deep, empathetic, meaningful conversation with some people and not so easy with others?
I think it's because when we're with people that we're very comfortable with, we sometimes forget to use these skills, right? We forget to prove that we're listening. We forget to ask them deep questions. In fact, if we've had a fight recently, we get so sort of wrapped up in our own thoughts that we don't actually hear what they're saying. But what we know is that if you want to communicate better, if you think just a half an inch deeper about how this conversation and what's happening and what I want to say and what they want to say, then the conversation gets much better. And so sometimes in a conversation with, for instance, a spouse, we have to get a little bit more formal. When I come home now and I've had a bad day, my wife will often say to me, okay, do you want me to help you solve this together? Or do you just need to get this off your chest and just want to vent? And it feels so good when she asks me that. It's a little formal, right? It's kind of a weird question to ask each other. How should we communicate? And yet it's made all of our conversations so much better. In schools, they actually teach teachers that when a student comes to them with a problem, they should ask them, do you want me to help you? Do you want me to hug you? Or do you want me to hear you? Which are the three different kinds of conversations. And so I think that oftentimes when we are struggling to communicate with someone that we love and want to connect with, if we take a step back and ask ourselves, how can I use these skills more obviously in this conversation? It makes all the difference in the world.
Well, one of your chapters is called Every Conversation is a Negotiation.
Yes.
But I don't think most of us see the conversations we have in that framework. So how does seeing conversations as negotiations change how we navigate them?
Well, it's a special kind of negotiation, what's referred to in the academic literature as a quiet negotiation. And the goal of a quiet negotiation is not to win the biggest slice of the pie. The goal of a quiet negotiation is to find out what each person wants out of a discussion. And in fact, most people do this without thinking about it. So when we start a conversation, we might tell a joke just to see if the other person laughs. Is this going to be a formal conversation or a casual one? We might interrupt each other at first and then figure out that interruption isn't working. We need to take turns speaking. We conduct little experiments at the beginning of our conversation. And these experiments are very, very revealing if we allow ourselves to notice what they're revealing. If we pay attention to, I just told that joke, did they laugh or did it seem like they don't want to tell jokes? This isn't that kind of conversation. And when we do an experiment and it fails, we shouldn't see that as a failure. We should see it as a piece of information, a bit of data that helps us figure out how to connect with this person. And it becomes very intuitive. Our brains have evolved to make this into a habit, to be very good at this. Many people do it without even realizing they're doing it. The key is just to allow ourselves to hear those instincts, to listen to them, and to listen to the other person.
Dee writes, my friend who recently lost her mother told me about an interesting dream she had about her mother. My own mom had died several years before, but instead of probing deeper, I proceeded to try to interpret the dream. My friend shut down. I really blew it. I wish I could go back. And Wendy writes, as someone who has experienced the worst loss, my child, it was and continues to be shocking to me how little we know about how to communicate care and love to folks who are bereaved. I could write a lot on this, too much, but a few things. Say the name of the person who has died. To not do so is to disappear them again. The best response I've ever received was, tell me about him. Charles, I mean, that's a great example of a deep question. Tell me about him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's so beautiful. And in fact, this is exactly what happened to me. My dad died about 7 years ago. And I came back to work after the funeral. And of course, this was all I was thinking about. I'd been thinking about my dad for weeks. And I would bump into people and I would mention that I'd just been at his funeral. And inevitably, they would say, oh, my condolences. Or I'm so sorry. And then that was it. And if someone had asked me, tell me about your dad, like, what was he like? It would have meant the world to me. It's all I was thinking about. It's all I wanted to talk about. And often we don't ask those deep questions because we feel uncomfortable, because we're worried that the question won't be well received or we don't know what to say next. But when a question is an invitation, when it's posed as, tell me about your dad, what was he like? Then it doesn't become a commandment or a mandate. It gives us an opportunity to talk about the things that we're thinking about and feeling that are most important to us. And that's the greatest gift we can give a friend or a colleague or anyone we encounter.
Charles, what do you want us to know about your dad?
Oh, he was wonderful. He was a super communicator. I have 9 siblings like you. I come from a big family because he loved kids. And he just, he always made you feel like he was listening to you.
That listening piece is, I think the dynamics of it have changed significantly. And thanks for sharing that about your dad. Because when I think about the way you and I probably grew up communicating, it was face-to-face with people. And technology today, we're talking over Zoom or we're texting each other a lot. And yet so much of the way we communicate is nonverbal. So yeah. How do super communicators navigate conversations when there is an absence of some of the physical cues we rely on to understand the space the other person is in?
Absolutely. And we have so many forms of communication now, right? You can text someone, you could DM them, you can email them. I mean, what's interesting is this isn't the first time we faced this question. The internet didn't create it. About 100 years ago, when telephones first became popular, there were a number of studies that appeared that said people will never have real conversations on the telephone because they can't see each other. They won't be able to understand what the other person is really saying. And what's interesting is at that moment, they were right. Their early transcripts of telephone conversations show people basically using it like a telegraph. They would send over grocery orders or stock purchases, but not really talk to each other. But of course, by the time you and I and everyone listening were teenagers, we could talk on the phone for like 7 hours a night, and they were the most important conversations of our life. And that's because we learned that there's slightly different rules to telephone communication than face-to-face. And when you're talking to someone on the phone without realizing it, you often over-enunciate your words. You put more emotion into your voice because you know the person can't see your face. Now, we've been talking on phones for almost 100 years, but we've been texting each other and emailing, in some cases, only for 5 or 10 years. And so it's not surprising that we're still trying to learn to use these forms of communication. But what super communicators know is that each form of communication has slightly different rules. Hey, I should think about something different if I send you a string of emojis versus writing you an email versus calling you up. And when we get into trouble is when we forget to pay attention to those rules. We just assume an email is just like talking to someone. So I can be sarcastic because they're going to hear the sarcasm in my tone, which face-to-face they could. But over an email, they take you seriously and they get upset. And so when we just take half a second, just a beat, to ask myself, okay, what are the rules for this form of communication? How is a text different from an email? That's when oftentimes we take advantage best of that form of communication, and we're really able to connect with other people regardless of how we're interacting with them.
There's so much more I'd love to talk to you about, Charles. The book is, it's really fascinating, and there's so many great lessons, I think, to take away from the book. Charles Duhigg is an investigative journalist and the author of several books, including The Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better. His new book is called Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Charles, it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We'll end on this email from Aaron, who says, I'm a college librarian, and I often think that listening carefully and asking the right questions in response is key to doing my job well. I'm definitely not the loudest person in the room. Also, as a result of this practice, I've found students trust me and return to me for help, and not always academic help. I really treasure that. Today's producer was Haley Blassingame. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the NPR Wine Club. Get the world of wine delivered to your door. When you join the NPR Wine Club, you'll receive the stories behind every bottle and favorite NPR shows and personalities arriving in liquid form, like Weekend Edition Cabernet and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Zinfandel. The NPR Wine Club is a delicious way to support NPR's programming. If you're 21 or older, uncork a special offer at nprwineclub.org/podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp. What's the right amount of socializing for you? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can help you figure out your social sweet spot. Try therapy with BetterHelp at betterhelp.com/NPR.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.